Well, thank you for those much too generous words. It's very much my honor to be here. I am, as many of you, all of us are, I guess I should say, an enormous fan of Professor Abrahams. And in fact, I have to tell you, when Penguin approached me about writing this book back in the fall of 2004, I was a little ambivalent about it. I have four children, I have a day job, but it was such a great opportunity. But I thought, you know, I need to ask some people what they think, you know. So I asked my husband, and he said, no, don't do it. So I asked a few friends, and they said, well, it could be really hard. And then I thought, well, let me ask some people I really respect in the law. And so the first person I called was a preeminent appellate lawyer in Washington, Miguel Estrada, who himself was a potential Supreme Court pick, very highly regarded. And so I said, I just wanted to get your thoughts, you know, knowing that he would be very familiar with the field and what work was there and what he thought I might be able to accomplish. So I said, I'm thinking about writing this book on the Supreme Court, looking at the Rehnquist Court, and then going through, whatever nomination and confirmation process that we might have. And he paused, and he said, And he said, why would you want to do that? And I said, well, it could be a really fascinating book. He said, but Henry Abrahams has completely covered the field. There's nothing more that you could add. And I said, well, I've read that book, but perhaps I could come up with something that I might be able to contribute. I started covering the Supreme Court in 1994, the same year that Justice Breyer joined the court. And that Supreme Court, with those nine justices, remained intact for the next 11 years. That was the longest period, as many of you I'm sure know, in the history of the Supreme Court with nine justices, that the court went without a change in membership. And so that court, with those justices, became quite a predictable group, led by Chief Justice William Rehnquist. We think of it as kind of closely divided on some of those key controversial social issues. We often would see it go 5-4, and more often than not, it was that pivotal vote of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who would often be carrying the day on some of these big social issue cases. But every term, after about the fifth or sixth year the court was together, we journalists would think, well, surely this year we're going to get a nomination. Surely there's going to be retirement. So we would dust off our notes and start writing those stories, and we would show up on the last day of the term, and then every day, every year, that term would come and go. In 2000, in the election, we were all quite confident that the next president would certainly get one, perhaps two, if not three, nominations to the Supreme Court, an enormous opportunity to shape the direction and future of the Supreme Court. So we reporters, who of course always know so much, all wrote stories saying how the presidential election of 2000 would be pivotal in shaping the future of the Supreme Court, because the next president would get one, two, or possibly three nominations. Well, as you know, the next year came and went, and no one stepped down. The Bush administration, in fact, fully expected retirements shortly after George Bush took office. They began vetting potential nominees, looking at prospects who might take the place of the next justice on the Supreme Court. So everyone expected a retirement, and no retirement ever came. So in the fall of 2005, with the presidential election on the horizon, at this moment, it certainly became clear that whoever the president was then would get a nomination. And the weekend before, as you all know, the Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, announced that he was ill with thyroid cancer. It didn't make much of a stir, surprisingly. Journalists wrote a few stories, myself included, of course. Some of the interest groups tried to drum up coverage in that to suggest that, you know, the stakes for the presidential election were even higher. But the court insisted that William Rehnquist would be back on the bench soon, that he wasn't that ill. And so, as you know, the presidential election came, and George Bush was again reelected. And we all expected William Rehnquist to be back on the bench. But his seat went vacant, of course, for the next 4 months, and people began to believe with with certainty that he would be forced to step down. In fact, many of us believe that we would never see Rehnquist back on the bench again. He missed 4 months of arguments, and Justice John Paul Stevens, the most senior justice, filled in for him. He started running the show at the Supreme Court. And those of you who have been to the court or know people who've clerked there know that Rehnquist ran things with a pretty tight hand. You know, if, when a lawyer's time was up, he would see that red light, and it was almost like he'd push a button and a trap door would open. You'd cut him off right when that red light came on. Well, Stevens didn't do that. He ran things a little looser and kind of loosened things up in the conference. The court started having a different feel without the Chief Justice running the show. But Rehnquist was ever that tough old Lutheran, and he swore President Bush in during that wintry inauguration ceremony and was back on the bench after missing those 4 months of arguments. But he was a very changed man in appearance. He was so thin. I remember one time he came in the courtroom and his wristwatch, you know, he had lost so much weight that it was rested around his knuckles. And he had had a tracheotomy, so he had this booming baritone, and his clerks all talk when they say tell their Rehnquist stories. They'll all talk like the Chief Justice in that deep voice. And when he went back on the bench with that tracheotomy, that booming baritone was gone. His voice was reedy and windy from the tracheotomy. But you know, if you put your hands over your ears, you could see it was still that same Rehnquist. He was still cutting lawyers off. He was still firing questions. He made no concessions to his weakened condition. But we all just knew that William Rehnquist was going to have to retire if he lived that long. It was clear that he was gravely ill. The other justices believed that he would step down. The White House fully believed that he would step down at the end of June. They began secretly interviewing replacements, looking for nominees who would replace the Chief Justice. So they interviewed countless candidates in a small, select judicial advisory group led by the Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and Vice President Cheney and Karl Rove, interviewing potential nominees in the Vice President's residence. And up on the court, it was a tough year for those justices. As Rehnquist was suffering, the other justices suffered with him because he was a well-liked leader. You know, even though he had that stern demeanor on the bench, the other justices were quite fond of him. They liked his leadership style. Justice Ginsburg, obviously not someone who saw eye to eye with him ideologically, affectionately referred to Rehnquist as my chief. Justice O'Connor, an old friend from the West, always liked his style, just to go on to the next day and the next case, and he never played favorites with opinion assignments. He was a liked, well-liked leader. And so the conferences, when he was back, some of the justices told me that, you know, they felt a little constrained in what they could say. They didn't want to disagree as much or as forcefully with the Chief Justice. Some of them wrote more opinions that term because the Chief Justice was in that weakened condition. And again, they all assumed that Rehnquist would be stepping down. Even his old friend from the West, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who had gone to law school with the Chief Justice in Stanford 50 years before. So with the trials of the term behind her, O'Connor seemed to be looking forward to another year on that court. She had hired her law clerks for the next term, and she had scheduled her public speeches so they didn't conflict with the days that the court was in session. With the end of June approaching, O'Connor went to talk to Rehnquist. She had gone to see him before, and he had told her to wait. That surprised O'Connor, because she expected him to tell her that he was going to step down. But he'd been coming to court every day. Still, she, like the other justices, believed the chief would be retiring soon. She thought she had spent one more year on the court before retiring herself. And Rehnquist had been emphatic in that earlier discussion that they had had. The court didn't need two retirements at the same time. Her guess was that he would announce his retirement, allowing her to stay one more year. She guessed wrong. "I want to stay another year," Rehnquist told O'Connor. Years earlier, Rehnquist had vowed not to linger at the court, that no man was bigger than the institution he served. Now, facing death, Rehnquist wasn't ready to leave a job that had defined his life. Say not the struggle not availeth, went the words of his favorite poem. Westward look, the land is bright. Rehnquist was not ready to give up. But then in this private discussion with O'Connor, he delivered a message she had heard before, but this time with a stunning implication. And I don't think we need two vacancies. O'Connor, the trailblazing jurist who was arguably the most powerful woman in America, was caught off guard. Rehnquist's implication was clear. She must retire now or be prepared to serve two more years. Her opinions had determined the direction of the court, reshaped American culture, and preserved the constitutional right to an abortion. But now Rehnquist, ravaged by cancer and desperately ill, was unilaterally deciding both of their fates. He would stay, and she should either step down now or be prepared to serve longer than she wanted. The 75-year-old O'Connor had been willing to remain another year, but because of her husband's illness, that would be it. Since the day he met Sandra Day, John O'Connor III had spent his life providing unconditional love and support. Unlike his wife, he never doubted that O'Connor would get that nomination after she met with President Reagan, and he never doubted that she could handle the job, even in those early days when, as a new justice, she couldn't sleep and lost weight from the pressure of being the first female on the highest court. O'Connor had no idea, absolutely none, how she would hold up in the face of historic pressure. She soon received her answer, her husband. Sandra O'Connor had always imagined that she and John would retire to Arizona, where they had kept a home the entire time they'd lived in Washington. They'd spend more time with their grandchildren, on the golf course, traveling around the world. But now it was clear that wouldn't happen. The face of retirement had changed. John was battling Alzheimer's, the same debilitating disease that crippled and killed the president who nominated O'Connor as an associate justice 2 decades earlier. It was her turn to support her husband before the disease stole him from her for good. She hadn't thought she'd be retiring at the end of that term, but it soon started to sink in. "Well, okay," O'Connor said, deferring to her old friend in chief. "I'll retire then." And with that exchange, the fading Rehnquist delivered to conservatives the vote they had craved for more than a decade. Now George W. Bush and his Republican Congress could begin the realignment of the Supreme Court. Bush would not be replacing a conservative with a conservative. He would replace the justice who often dictated the direction of the court. But of course, none of us knew about this exchange, which was in June, and we all continued to believe that Rehnquist, who was obviously fading away, would be stepping down the last day of the term that year in 2005. The courtroom was filled with people who had come to see this historic announcement when the Chief Justice, after leading that court so ably for so many years, would announce that he was retiring. And the justices themselves seemed to sense the kind of historic nature of the moment. So the justices filed in the courtroom, and you could just feel the anticipation that people had come to see this great man say that he was stepping down. And the court went through all of its decisions because, as you know, the Supreme Court always saves the biggest, most controversial ones to the end, and this year was no exception. They had that big Ten Commandments case, and that was the one that Rehnquist summarized, the last case of the term. And then he paused, and he looked around, if you remember, and he thanked the court staff because, again, it had been a difficult year for the court, and he thanked them for all their work. And he labored over his words, almost struggling to get through them. And then he paused again, and he looked around, and everyone kind of leaned up in their seats. Some of the justices kind of craned their necks down because this was the moment when Rehnquist would announce his retirement. And instead, the gavel banged, and Rehnquist slowly rose. And some of the justices themselves looked confused. I remember seeing Justice Breyer, and you know, no one quite knew what to do. It was only O'Connor who had that sense of purpose. She immediately stood up, ready to help her old friend in chief out of the courtroom, and the justices left. those of us in the courtroom weren't quite sure what to expect. We thought maybe we would hear an announcement from Rehnquist sometime that week. Of course it wouldn't be his style, we concluded, to do something so dramatic as to announce it in the court. He was a low-key guy. He would just release a statement. That's what he was going to do. But instead, it was Justice O'Connor, after that discussion with Rehnquist, who delivered the bombshell on that Friday morning that she would be retiring after 24 years on the court. And of course, this changed everything. Because as I said, when the Bush administration was thinking it was going to get a nomination, it was going to be replacing the Chief Justice, who was a solid conservative, presumably with another conservative. But with O'Connor's retirement, George Bush had a moment, a historic moment, to change the direction of the court. Now, this was a Supreme Court led by William Rehnquist that in many ways had become a huge disappointment to conservatives. This was a court with seven justices nominated by Republican presidents, yet this was a court that on case after case of those social issues that everyone cares about, whether it was abortion, affirmative action, religion, presidential power, this court took a more liberal path. And more often than not, that path was dictated by Justice O'Connor by a vote of 5-4. Now, in putting together the book, I looked at why was that? How could this Supreme Court, with those seven justices nominated by Republican presidents, become such a surprise to conservatives who had quite high expectations? Because remember, many of these presidents specifically sought to change the direction of the Supreme Court. President Reagan, with his three nominations, really emphasized that they had hoped to change the direction of the court away from some of those landmark rulings of the more liberal Warren and Berger courts. President George H.W. Bush had two nominations and replaced two liberal icons. Yet this court stopped short of fulfilling conservative goals. In some cases, the justices weren't as conservative as advertised, such as David Souter, of course. In others, the justices affected each other. Because if you think about the Supreme Court, obviously these are nine very independent justices. They have their own offices, and they can decorate them however they want, so they're all, you know, decorated quite differently. I mean, for example, O'Connor, kind of cowgirl from Arizona, she had this beautiful office decorated in these warm southwestern colors. She used for her coffee table, she had these big ceremonial drums that I always kind of felt like I wanted to bang on when I would go in there. You know, Justice Breyer's office, he's kind of a, he's an intellectual and speaks French, and so his office is, you know, got this roaring fire in the fireplace and books just piled everywhere, very kind of reflective of his style. Justice Ginsburg, the New York intellectual that she is, her office is quite modern in its decor. So, you know, they're all very different, very independent. They have their own staffs, their own law clerks, their own library, law books in their offices. But at the same time, they very much define themselves in relation to one another, so that when a new justice comes on the court, it's a new court, as Justice White famously said. And one of the pivotal things about shaping the Rehnquist Court was, I believe, some of those group dynamics, particularly as it affected Justices O'Connor and Kennedy. One of the most fascinating things that I looked at in thinking about how the Rehnquist Court came to be the Rehnquist Court was the role of Justice Clarence Thomas and the misunderstood role of Justice Thomas. Now, if you remember, Justice Thomas came onto the Supreme Court after those bitter confirmation hearings in 1991. And it was a time when conservatives very much believed that they had changed the direction of the Supreme Court firmly to the right. Just the year before, President H.W. Bush had put on David Souter, as I said, to replace William Brennan, that liberal icon. And then he got another chance the next year, nominating Clarence Thomas to replace another liberal giant, Thurgood Marshall. But instead that year, the court turned inexplicably to the left. And one of the most fascinating things is you can see the presence and the effect of Justice Thomas when he went on that court. Now, you know, everyone, the storyline on Justice Thomas pretty quickly developed when he came on the court, that he was just a lackey of Scalia, that he was following in Scalia's footsteps. People were writing these things. They would see Thomas and Scalia voting together, and they would just assume that Thomas was just following Scalia. Newspaper articles were written, columns, headlines. And in my research, I discovered it was patently and demonstrably false. And that year, if any justice was changing his mind to join the other, it was Scalia who was changing his mind to join Justice Thomas. And it started from the very first week that Thomas joined the Supreme Court. In his first conference, the justices, that's when they all go into that very private, beautifully wood-paneled conference room, and no one else can come in. It's only the justices, and they all sit around a table, and they all go in order of seniority by their discussion, where they talk about cases, and then they vote on the cases. So in Justice Thomas's very first conference, the third case that was discussed, it was a case from Louisiana and involved the state's efforts to keep this criminal defendant in a mental institution, and he wanted out. So the Chief Justice started the conversation, and he concluded, Rehnquist concluded, that he was siding with the defendant in the case. And then the discussion went on down the line. The next justice agreed with Rehnquist. He said he was going to join Rehnquist as well. On down the line, it got to Justice Thomas. All eight justices had cast their votes with the Chief Justice, William Rehnquist. Thomas paused, and he said he, too, was going to join with the Chief Justice. But he couldn't sleep that night. And the next morning, he went back to the court and into the chambers of the Chief Justice, and he said, I threw in the towel. I was wrong. That's not how I see the case. I should have stuck to my guns, and I want to change my vote. I'm going to dissent. And the Chief Justice said, well, okay, why don't you circulate your dissent, and that'll be that. So Justice Thomas wrote up his dissent, circulated it around to the other justices, and that's how they do things a lot. They don't have a lot of debate face-to-face in those conferences, but they do it a lot in the writing. They'll write the opinion, send it around. Some justices will weigh in and say, why don't you add this? Why don't you say this? And so it's a lot of give and take in the writing. And so Justice Thomas circulated his dissent in this case. And remember, it looked like it was going to be 8-1. But a couple weeks later, he got a note back from Justice Scalia. And Scalia said, you've persuaded me. I'm changing my vote. And then about a week after that, he got a note from the Chief Justice. Clarence, I'm changing my vote. I'm joining your dissent. And then another week after that, Justice Kennedy sent around another note. He, too, was changing his vote. That case ended up being 5-4. Thomas's arguments persuaded three justices to change their votes. That was the first case, that was the first conference when he was a new justice. And it happened often that term, where Scalia would change his vote and join Justice Thomas. But of course, as I said, that wasn't the storyline, because when people saw those two justices voting together, they believed that Thomas was just following Scalia. That was never the case. He was completely independent and forceful from the beginning. But Justice Thomas's arrival in the court had an unexpected effect. It caused not his personality, he was a very well-liked person at the court, but the forcefulness of his views caused Justice O'Connor to move to the left. Justice O'Connor joined the court, nominated by President Reagan, and she was a pretty conservative, reliable conservative vote, voting often with the Chief Justice. But over the years, she began to move a little to the left. However, not too far, because there was William Brennan on the court, and he and Justice O'Connor had some words immediately after she joined the court, and she never really trusted him. In fact, Justice Powell warned her that sometimes Justice Brennan could put some language in a footnote. You always had to be a little wary of what he might be willing to do. So she was always a little wary of Justice Brennan, and I believe that prevented her, his strong presence on the left, prevented her from moving further to the left. So in 1990, Justice Brennan leaves the court to be replaced by David Souter. And then the next year, Clarence Thomas comes on, a very forceful, independent conservative. And so without that force field of Brennan, that enabled O'Connor to move more to the left that term, and where she pretty much stayed for the rest of her tenure on the court. And as a result, that term, when the court had these huge cases, conservatives were certain the court was going to overturn Roe versus Wade or greatly restrict a woman's right to an abortion. They certainly were going to allow prayer at school graduation ceremonies, and instead that term, the court did just the opposite, surprising everyone. So these group dynamics can have a profound effect on the court as an institution, and it's one reason why that Supreme Court didn't move to the right as conservatives and certainly the presidents who nominated those justices had hoped. The lawyers in the Bush White House were keenly aware of that. And so when O'Connor announced her resignation, those lawyers set to work to find a nominee to replace her who would be a solid conservative and one who would not move to the left once on the court, but also one who would be very collegial and congenial, who could build alliances, whose views maybe wouldn't have those sharp elbows that Scalia had, who could perhaps persuade wavering colleagues like Justice Kennedy. And they knew they had to get it right. George Bush, his advisors told me, was seared, and that's the word they used, seared by his father's decision to nominate David Souter. And that decision, his father's decision, drove his thinking in the process of nominating replacements for the Chief Justice and then ultimately for O'Connor and then ultimately the Chief Justice. So when it came time to replace Justice O'Connor, of course, the president tapped John Roberts, who had clerked for the Chief Justice, and we all thought that that Rehnquist would be back and that perhaps Roberts would be serving alongside his old chief. But the weekend before the hearings for John Roberts were to begin, the Chief Justice died at his home in Virginia. And President Bush didn't hesitate. He, the next morning, called John Roberts at home, asked him if he could meet him in the White House. Of course, Roberts said, "Certainly, Mr. President." And that afternoon, President Bush had his mind made up. The next morning, he introduced John Roberts to the nation as the next nominee to replace Chief Justice William Rehnquist. And if I could just say as an aside, I was so struck by that time and what that must have been like for John Roberts. Here he was the weekend before his hearings were to begin for this pivotal seat, going on to the Supreme Court, obviously a young guy, very highly regarded, when the man that he had called boss for all those years died. And then the president asked him to replace him. And then the next morning, that Monday morning, as he's announced to the nation as the new nominee to be the next Chief Justice, Rehnquist's family called Roberts and asked him if he would be a pallbearer for Rehnquist's funeral. And so Roberts himself, with other clerks, actually helped carry Rehnquist's coffin into the great, up the steps and into the great hall of the Supreme Court where Rehnquist's body was going to be lying in repose. And I'll never forget just watching Roberts. He kind of stood off to the side. And his hands, he was kind of grasping them so tightly that you could see the knuckles were kind of almost white and his jaw was very tightly clenched, like he was just kind of trying to keep his emotions. And the clerks who had worked clerk for Rehnquist kind of were off in a group there to pay tribute, and the justices themselves were kind of off to this side, and Roberts just stood back. You know, he wasn't really one of them anymore, a former clerk, but he wasn't yet a justice either. And I just thought, you know, if you had written that as a movie, I mean, no one would have believed that here was this man and it's serving the pallbearer for the man that he was going to be replacing and leading that court for the next decades to come. The senators, of course, postponed the hearings until the next week because the position itself had changed. And that set in motion this incredible chain of events down Pennsylvania Avenue to again find another replacement, because with Roberts leaving that nomination to be the next O'Connor, President Bush had to find another nominee to take Justice O'Connor's seat. So he called Justice O'Connor from Air Force One and said, "You better get back to your homework. I think you're going to be coming back to the Supreme Court until we can find someone to replace you." So she did. She came back to the court. while the White House looked for another nominee to replace Justice O'Connor. And it was at this moment that George Bush was deeply influenced by some of those missteps and past mistakes that conservatives believed other presidents had made. As I said, he was seared by his father's decision to nominate David Souter. And that drove him to nominate, if you can believe this, Harriet Myers. He believed that his dad had gotten really bad advice. You know, his dad didn't know David Souter. His father's advisors assured him that David Souter was a solid conservative, that he would not change once he got on the court. And of course, they had no idea what they were talking about. George W. Bush knew Harriet Myers. He knew that she was a conservative. He believed that she would not change. And he wanted to nominate a woman. He told his chief of staff, Andy Card, that he wanted to nominate a woman or a minority. And so Card went to the lawyers in the White House with a sharp directive of no white guys. And so they looked far and wide, and they came up short. And keep in mind, you know, there had been 8 years of Clinton appointees. So some of the potential candidates who had been nominated back in the late 80s, mid-late 80s, and early 1990s were getting older because Bush had wanted to put someone on who would be on the court a long time. Others weren't seen as conservative enough, and of course the White House was very concerned and they very much wanted to get it right. And then still others had ethical problems, you know, or nothing that could get them off the bench, but in that climate on the Hill, something that could be seen as a negative, making it difficult to get through. So as the White House lawyers kind of came up short, George Bush became more and more enamored with the idea of nominating Harriet Myers. And he got no pushback on it. You know, his political advisors told him that they could get her confirmed. Some of the other lawyers in the White House believed that she was qualified for the Supreme Court. And it was only one man, ironically, who raised opposition to her nomination, and that was the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, who, of course, had long been considered a not potential nominee himself. And, of course, conservatives were quite opposed to his nomination because they believed, as they said, Gonzalez was Spanish for Souter. So he was going to get up there and just go to the left just like that guy David Souter did. So Al Gonzalez, when he heard that the president was going to nominate Harriet Myers, felt like he needed to discuss this with him, but he was reluctant. And he told his advisors, he said, you know, I don't want them to think that this is about me, you know, about my nomination. And they insisted. They said, you have a duty to the president. You have to advise him. Your loyalty is with the president. And so he went to the White House, and he met with President Bush in the Oval Office, and he laid out his concerns. He said, conservatives will revolt, and Harriet Myers is not qualified enough to overcome that to be on the Supreme Court. And, of course, President Bush didn't listen. He had made up his mind, and that next Monday, he nominated Harriet Myers to replace Sandra Day O'Connor. Now, just as Gonzalez predicted, conservatives went crazy, and it was such a strange time in Washington, because here we had this battle for this pivotal seat, you know, that would change the direction of the court. Groups on both sides had raised millions ready for this battle. And so when the president nominated Harriet Myers, conservatives came out in opposition. And the Democrats and the liberals, who were ready to wage war against whoever President Bush would nominate to the Supreme Court, instead didn't know what to do. So they just kind of held their fire. As Harriet Myers herself, over the next couple weeks, began talking with senators, working in her preparation sessions, and all of which went poorly on all fronts. And as I guess is an understatement, although I have to say, I find the story of Harriet Myers sad. I mean, she wasn't a constitutional lawyer. And in this day and age, senators and everyone have come to expect, and particularly after seeing John Roberts go through his hearings and his meetings with the senators, just on the heels of that, they've come to expect a certain ability to discuss these complex constitutional topics. And she struggled to get through those meetings with the senators. Even senators who were loyal and sympathetic to the White House were completely underwhelmed when she met with Senator Sessions from my great state of Alabama. At the end of it, he looked at her and he said, Harriet, you know, next time you're going to have to say something. And then she met with Tom Coburn, another very loyal Bush administration defender, and oddly asked him at the end of their discussion, well, what did you think? How'd I do? And he looked at her and he said, Harriet, in his very plain-spoken way, you flunked. And those stories were, of course, circulating around the Hill and getting back to the White House, while at the same time, Harriet Myers was undergoing these rigorous preparation sessions with lawyers from inside the administration at the Justice Department. And those were going no better. You know, Harriet Myers had been a lawyer in Texas, a manager, but again, she wasn't a constitutional lawyer. And as one lawyer told me who was trying to help vet her, they came to feel that it was like trying to teach, as they put it, trying to teach French to someone in 3 or 4 weeks and then expecting them to pass a fluency exam. They just couldn't teach her those complex constitutional topics and expect her to get through that hearing. So President Bush and Andy Card had a painful meeting on October 25th, actually, which is my birthday. I can remember that date. And the writing was on the wall, and they both realized that she must withdraw her nomination because it was going to be too painful for her, and President Bush believed that the Democrats would be unable to resist just eviscerating her, because the worse they could make her look, the worse that it would, of course, make him look for nominating her. So Andy Card, President Bush's chief of staff, went to see her. And he started saying, you know, things aren't going well. And she didn't pick up on his message at all. And she said, well, we're working, and I'm working, and we're continuing to do battle on all fronts. And so then the next morning, her own deputy, Bill Kelly, went into her office and was much more forceful and laid out the case for why she needed to withdraw. And he said, you know, putting it quite delicately at first, that this was a moment when her interests and the president's interests were very much in unison, and both meant that she should withdraw. And Harriet's Myers' response was very much like President Bush had advertised her. She said, no, we can't quit. You know, I'll learn it. I can do it. You know, she was that, remember how Bush had called her that a pit bull in size 6 shoes? You know, she showed that toughness. She didn't want to give up. So it took one more meeting from Andy Card later that day for her to realize that the president himself wanted her to withdraw her nomination. So that night, she wrote her letter to President Bush. And that night, Bill Kelly called Samuel Alito in his chambers in New Jersey and asked if he would still be interested in serving on the Supreme Court. Now, Alito is a quiet man. He's reserved. And the other justices I have obviously been talking to since he joined the court say, you know, he's just kind of like a shy lawyer, you know. But when Bill Kelly asked him that, he was quite emphatic. He said, yes, he was still interested in serving on the Supreme Court. So the next morning, the president announced that Harriet Myers was withdrawing her nomination. And then that next Monday, he announced that Samuel Alito would be nominated to replace him. Now, at that moment, all the stars went back in alignment. You know, the conservatives were thrilled. The liberals were outraged. So all the groups in Washington, you know, they fell right back into their proper places. And Harriet Myers, I think much to her credit, was firmly on board to support Sam Alito and worked diligently throughout that process to get him confirmed. In fact, he had been her favorite, her top choice from the beginning. Interestingly enough, she was a little dubious about John Roberts. You know, we think about John Roberts is someone, it's hard to imagine him flubbing anything. But his first interview when he met with the vice president and that screening interview hadn't gone particularly well. And, you know, the answers were kind of short and he wasn't quite sure what they were trying to ask him. And so they were kind of underwhelmed, and it took some persuasion by Bill Kelly and other supporters to get him on that short list to go in and meet with President Bush when O'Connor stepped down. And Roberts also had played things very close to the vest. He wasn't somebody who went to Federalist Society meetings or advertised himself as a conservative. So There were some conservatives, like Harriet Myers, who worried that he really was not conservative. So initially, there was that reluctance, and Myers was one of those who was quite skeptical. She, of course, was ultimately persuaded once some of Robert's writings and other opinions and people began talking to her knew them. But she never was skeptical of Alito. She very much liked his qualities, and the president did as well. Now, at this moment, the pump was primed. There was going to be a huge battle because Alito was clearly conservative, and liberals believed they had a smoking gun to derail him. He had argued in a memo that he was proud of his support for arguing in opposition to Roe versus Wade. He was opposed to affirmative action. All the things that, you know, people were digging through files to find. They had found those kind of aha documents. But Alito himself was so effective in his testimony that the Democrats were really unable to get any traction. And so, of course, he ultimately was confirmed by the Senate and now has taken his place on the court. And with Alito now taking Justice O'Connor's place and John Roberts leading the court, I believe that George Bush has succeeded, finally, where past Republican presidents had failed in turning the court to a more conservative direction. The president nominated two first-rate intellectuals, but also two justices who were collegial, congenial, very well-liked by their colleagues, and very well-liked already by the other justices on the court. That gives them an opportunity to have more discussions and build bridges and coalitions with the other justices. And I think we'll begin to see it this term when the justices are taking up some very explosive cases on abortion and race and global warming, where we will see the court begin turning more clearly to the right. But, of course, not completely, because there's one justice that we're all going to be looking to, and that justice is named Anthony Kennedy. He is a swing vote nominated by President Reagan, someone that now people think will be the next O'Connor, the next justice who determines the direction of the court. I'm a little skeptical of that because, first of all, Justice Kennedy is more conservative than Justice O'Connor was. But also I think that we will see the influence of Roberts as a leader in persuading Justice Kennedy. And we've already seen that. Our Chief Justice has been talking about the need for unanimity and more narrow opinions. And that, to me, is clearly designed to kind of scale back the influence of Justice Kennedy. If he can get the court to move in a more narrow direction, it can kind of rein in Kennedy from some of the big, bold, grandiose opinions that outraged conservatives so much. So this term, of course, and next to come, will be interesting to see the role of Kennedy and how Roberts is and or is not effective in reining him in, because I believe that one thing that he does not want to happen is that he is presiding over the Kennedy court, like his predecessor presided over the O'Connor court.